Welcome to the Hardware Asylum Podcast. This episode, we take our first look at the long-awaited Z690 Dark from EVGA, and we check in on our progress on the Retro PC subwoofer project. I'm your host, Dennis Garcia, and with me today, I have Darren McKay. Listeners of the Hardware Asylum podcast will have recognized that when I talk about when we record, it's usually in the Hardware Asylum labs or the Ninja Lane labs, which is also Building A, or more traditionally, my garage.
Exactly.
And it was a relatively untreated space. It was relatively large as well, so we didn't have a lot of weird, crazy echoes, aside from the microphones just being right across the table from each other. And it worked out pretty well. But, you know, it's summertime here in the Idaho area, and we've relocated temporarily.
We have, because there's been a record streak of hot days, like the hottest recorded summer ever in Idaho.
Really?
It's true. More days over 100 than have ever been recorded.
Oh, yeah. The more days over. Yeah, because that was like the entire month of August was over 100, and it never got down to below 70 at night, which was odd, because here in the high desert, we would have this, what is it, 60-degree temperature shift most times.
Yeah, it was usually really nice right about the time the sun started setting, and just a beautiful, beautiful time to be out, but not this year.
Not so much. So we are at Darren's house, of all places.
We are off-site.
Off-site.
Location B, I guess.
And let me tell you, moving all of this stuff out of the Hardware Science Labs over here is a bit of a chore. It took a little while, but we're going to see how it works.
That's right. So maybe it will cool down and we won't have to do this again. But in the short run, hopefully everything sounds okay.
And if you hear any weird thumps or gurgles or whatever in the background, we can blame Darren.
That's right. My fault.
So I did bring over some toys, though. More stuff I packed from the Hardware Science Labs.
Ooh.
The first one we're going to talk about is right here.
Oh.
I made a slap.
Nice. Now, I'm excited about this because I think this is the latest Raptor Lake, right?
No, it's not the Raptor Lake.
Oh, okay.
So Darren is talking about the next generation Intel processor and chipset. You can go out to the Wikipedias. I'll put a link down in the show notes to go and check it out. But basically, the 700 series Intels are supposed to be out a little bit later this year.
Well, and that's not entirely a joke, because I did want to point out that this is, and I'll share, we're looking at the latest Kingpin Edition motherboard from EVGA. It is officially the Z690 Dark Kingpin Edition.
The Dark.
And one of the reasons I wanted to make the joke about the 700 series is because we've been hearing a lot about the 700 series, and this motherboard with the 690 has been out for a while, though, hasn't it?
It has. It's been out for, I don't know, 6 or 8 months or something like that. I have several reviews of the 690 on the Hardware Asylum website. Be sure to check those out. This particular board, though, was kind of late to the market, much like the DFI boards back in the day.
So what took them so long? I'm going to start to open this up because I want to take a look at it. Oh, it's heavy.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of stuff in there. I believe what happened was we have the fallout of the chip shortage. So EVGA has been kind of retooling and rebranding themselves, so to speak. They've been focusing a lot on pushing out video cards. That's what they've been known for. And they've also diversified. So, I mean, they have headphone amplifiers. They've been doing power supplies for a really long time. And for the Z690, they only had two motherboards available. They had the Z690 classified, and that was available pretty much at launch time. And according to their website, it was listed for $630.
Wow, but not today.
Not today. As of this recording, you can buy them for $300, which is pretty cool.
Pretty good deal, actually.
And then we have the second one, which is the board here. This is the EVGA Z690 Dark Kingpin Edition.
Some fancy packaging.
It has Vince's signature on the front, which is pretty crazy. So if you touch it, you know, and rub it in the right direction, you'll be able to get super world records and whatnot.
That's right. Just make sure you don't pray to it, because that would be weird.
Yeah, that would be super weird. In terms of cost, we can get this one now for $500. It's on an instant rebate of $330. So if you can do the simple math, that was $830 brand new.
Ooh, now this thing is heavy, but it is beautiful. All right, I've got it out of the package. Okay. I see there's a back plate. Yeah, yeah. Very pretty.
And of course, this is radio, so you're going to have to go with our descriptions of what the board is like.
So I want to share my first impression because I immediately see a lot of really cool branding on this.
Oh, yeah.
The heatsink has dark in it.
Yeah, so that's embossed into the little fins. Underneath it is going to be our NVMe slots.
Got some beautiful kingpin gold on, what is this, the bridge, right?
Yeah, that's the MCP, or the basically the south.
A lot of heat sinks. But I almost immediately turned it over because it didn't feel right. And there's a massive backplate on it, which I thought was still in the package. Mm-hmm. And it is also branded with a really slick cutout for dark and the kingpin stuff.
So, yeah, the backplate is the standard aluminum. They've been doing these on several boards, but they've gone above and beyond. So we have a large opening here to get access to the heatsink.
Right.
And it's also it's dipped in. That's kind of cool. I see
that. It's got a little texture, so it's not just plain.
And down here we have dark, which is silk screened onto the back of the motherboard PCB. And then they've accented it on the backplate, saying Z690, and then kingpin is down in the lower right.
So you're getting a little extra for your money with just the aesthetics on this thing alone.
Yeah. Well, and the nice thing about having the backplate on this particular board is that if you run this on an open bench or whatnot, that gives you a lot of extra support on the PCB for having heavy heat sinks and stuff like that on it.
Okay. Well, let's take a look at this thing. What makes it special? The first functional thing that jumps out at me, Dennis, is there's only two RAM slots.
Okay, so the two RAM slots has been a staple on every one of the dark motherboards, and that is because this particular board is designed for memory overclocking. And the best way to ensure good signal integrity from the CPU to the memory slots is to reduce the amount of traces going in that direction.
Very nice. I guess the same could be said for the two expansion slots. You only got two choices here.
You actually have more than just two. Although the two slots here are their full-length 16X PCI Express. I believe it probably divides down to 8, and it depends on how you use the NVMe slots.
Right.
But check this out. I'm removing a little rubber cover.
Ooh.
That is the last bit of PCI Express bandwidth coming from the chipset itself. This is a 4X slot down at the very bottom, and the end of it is open, allowing you to put much longer cards in there.
Clever. I like the way they've hidden that. I didn't even notice.
Yeah, that's one thing that I like about this particular board. Ooh. And I haven't really dove into a lot of what this board has to offer, but most everything that you're not going to use is covered. Yeah, so we have this plastic cover down here, and that's basically covering all of the PCI Express slots and some of the connectivity for front panel connections and USB slots. Front panel
audio. And it looks like there's one that covers the motherboard on-offs and lights and all that good stuff.
Front panel I/O, so to speak.
Right. And then this last one, of course, is everything else. That's clever because they're hiding pretty good, which would be good for benching, right?
It gives the board a little bit of curb appeal when you have it out on the open bench, because that's kind of what this board is intended for, is just for overclocking. Now, if we look on the I/O connections on the side here,
right,
we have a PS2 port, which is something that it made me chuckle. So on the overclocking boards, they add the PS2 port because lower latency off of legacy connections.
Right.
But there were a good, 5 or 6 years where EVGA was blazing the trail and only offered USB. So they didn't have the PS2 port on, even on their overclocking boards.
So this is a return, I think, to classic overclocking, isn't it?
Yeah, a little bit. So we have also a couple of buttons here, and that's likely for reset and BIOS flash. We'll have to look into that a little bit.
Yeah, I see reset CMOS and BIOS update. Got it.
We have a couple of headers for Wi-Fi. Wi-Fi 6 that comes on board. That's actually embedded in the chipset itself. So any board that does not have it, they're kind of cheating the people that are buying the board itself. We have dual Ethernet, and we also have several USB ports, and these are probably 3.2s.
Yeah, that's nice. And of course, you got onboard HD audio, it looks like also.
Yeah, we have the full audio package here. So it's going to be, 7.1 surround, but then we also have a digital optical as well. The thing that you glossed over when you were looking at the memory slots is the orientation of the memory versus the CPU versus the power.
Okay, yeah. And but I didn't see anything unusual there other than the memory being on the opposite side of where it usually is because there's only two. What am I seeing here?
So the orientation of the CPU power supply and memory is something that EVGA has pioneered with later editions of the dark motherboard and is rotated 90 degrees. So what we would normally have is that the CPU VRM, which is off to the right, would be at the top of the motherboard.
Oh, and I do see that.
And the memory would be to the right of the CPU. And that's kind of the standard ATX orientation. Well, by rotating it 90 degrees, now we have better cable management, so to speak, because all of the CPU power and the main 24-pin header are on the right side of the motherboard in this little cutout, so we can tuck them under the PCB. The memory is at the top, giving it good airflow, so to speak.
Right.
And we have a huge open area around the CPU for LN2-style insulation. So we got a lot of room right there and less interference with some of the other components.
Very nice. So I noticed the heat sinks are really tall here. I mean, they're like a good inch and integrated, of course. It looks like they're over the VRMs, but the VRMs are, I guess, also rotated.
Yeah, so by rotating it 90 degrees, we put the CPU VRMs along the left-hand side of the motherboard by the I/O and also below the CPU between the topmost PCI Express slot. And those heat sinks are obviously to keep the VRMs cool.
But there's no active cooling. I don't see any fans, just giant heat sinks. I'm looking here to see if I've missed one.
No, and there's no active cooling, and that's something that a lot of motherboard manufacturers have been purposely excluding, not because you don't need it, because right. You do need to have active cooling, which is why you have a tall heatsink here. But by putting a fan on there, that's one more thing that they have to warranty.
Oh, okay. But I do see there's a pretty good-sized single heat pipe running through all of that also, though.
Yeah, the VRM heatsinks on the Dark Edition motherboards for the past forever, they've been extremely beefy. And that's where a lot of the weight comes from with that board. So along the right-hand side of the motherboard, we have SATA and it looks like a U.2 connections. It is fully featured in terms of the USB connectivity.
Well, I mean, a lot of times when we see a high-end overclocking specific motherboard, I feel like they tend to short you in some of maybe the quality of life features. And this is, I think, a great example of a motherboard that does both well. I mean, we've got the high-definition audio. We got all the familiar interfaces. We got room for additional cards. I don't feel like they've shorted me anything on this one.
No, they've not. And if the price is any indication, I mean, this motherboard was almost $900. That would indicate that not only is there quality components on the board, but they haven't skimped on anything. And we can see that based off of the size of the board itself, the weight of it, the size of the heat sinks, and all of the connectivity, plus what's in the box that we haven't looked at yet.
Oh, okay. Let me get that box back out. Set that over there. Yep. Now, this is what I thought was a backplate.
That is actually the base plate for a self-assembled bench table.
Oh, okay. So they are giving you something to mount this to for benching.
Yeah, this is a PCB blank of the actual motherboard. So on there is the silkscreen location of all of the components that are on the board, and there's these holes here, which would be the same holes on the board to mount it into a case, where you can take some really tall brass standoffs that come in the accessory box, assemble those here, and then you can mount this motherboard on that tray and use it in a real open bench situation.
Very nice. Okay, I'm going for the accessory box. Accessory kit.
Accessory kit.
Dun, dun, dun. I'm opening this bad boy up. Oh.
There is a ton of stuff in here.
What the? PCIe release assist? There's a stick.
They included the stick. Yeah, well, if you look at the heatsink here, it's freaking huge, right?
Yeah, oh yeah, I see.
It's right next to the topmost PCI Express slot. You cannot get your finger in there. I mean, on my bench at home, I have a large bamboo skewer that I use to go and hit that tab to remove the video card. Well, they decided to give us one.
That's hilarious, because like you, I have a long, narrow screwdriver that I always keep handy just for that purpose. Mm-hmm. All right, we got, wow, what a... stuff.
Oh yeah, we got some badges.
Case badges.
Oh, and this right here.
USB BIOS?
Yeah, this is where we have all the drivers because they do not include a driver disk. with the EVGA motherboard.
But that is
camera.
So nice, because then you don't have to get on the internet. So you have it handy.
Well, I believe that we should really have a DVD or a disc of some sort. The fact that EVGA is including a USB drive, I think that is the modern approach to supplying a
disc. It's kind of it's about time moment, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they're cheap. Why not? And it's tiny. I mean, this couldn't have cost them much, right?
No.
And it doesn't even really need to be high speed.
And it's a lot better than the ASUS and the Gigabyte implementation that has that little chip on the board and then requires you to connect to the internet to download all the drivers.
Right.
And it's like, well, what happens if you don't have internet access or that the Ethernet driver doesn't load when you install Windows 10 or 11?
What a hassle. And I've been there, you know, and you're kind of screwed unless you have a backup PC, which fortunately you do, unless you're out on the road trying to do overclocking.
Those are the long brass standoffs for the bench table.
I like that. Gives the board room to breathe. Of course, we got the typical screws for mounting. They're also black. Nice to go with the dark theme. Oh, I like that too. Probit cable.
Oh, yeah. So the Probit cables, those are the voltage test points. And at the very top of the motherboard over here, right above the memory sockets, there's a series of pins. And you plug in your Probit into that, and then you can plug your VOHM leads into that and then monitor voltages as you're overclocking, so you can watch it in real time.
Very cool. Yeah. Nice option.
I'm not sure if you've noticed, but when I overclock these at, say, Hackfort and whatnot, I usually had my VOHM listed there so I could watch the voltages change and see if we're getting a weird droop or anything.
Big package of thermal pads. Very nice.
And that's so if you remove any of the VRM heat sinks for insulation purposes or whatever, you can put the pads back on in case you tear them.
Very nice. Of course, we got a couple of giant antennas for our wireless connectivity.
Yeah, the Wi-Fi 6.
And let's see, well, now we're back down to more standard stuff. Nice black cables for all your usual drives and such.
Yeah, and EVGA is good about including enough SATA cables for all of the ports that are on the motherboard. Some of the modern boards that I've been reviewing lately come with maybe two. But in all actuality, we really should be moving to NVMe, and the fact that you have SATA ports doesn't necessarily mean you need to have all the cables.
Well, and I want to point out also that not only have they provided a full range of cables, but these are all the nice locking cables. These are good cables, not the cheapies. Mm-hmm. Locks on both ends, so very cool.
In a sense, we are getting what we pay for, which is good.
Yeah, I mean, especially at that price point, you want to get the premier experience. Mm-hmm. And I think that you deserve it, really.
Well, be sure to look for this particular review on Hardware Asylum coming soon with this particular podcast. This is really the unboxing of this particular board. Not more than a couple of hours before coming over here, I had opened it up to make sure that the board was in there and it wasn't damaged. And all of us are seeing this board at the same time.
Fantastic. Well, I look forward to seeing what this will do on the bench, because it looks like it's going to be an impressive overclocker. Thanks for sharing. So Dennis, I know that in our podcast last month, we talked a little bit about this project, and the project I'm speaking of is the attempt to build a, I guess, retro custom speaker box. Is that the right way of putting it?
I want good sound for my retro machines.
There we go.
Yeah.
And we had talked about disassembling and rebuilding a Logitech system, bigger, better, stronger.
Yeah.
And I think we almost immediately identified that the key area where we could improve on our beautiful little budget Logitech system.
Our $50 Logitech 2-in-1.
Was to improve on the bass, because who doesn't want more bass fill? Mm-hmm. But we didn't want to go crazy. I think that's important to point out. We wanted something appropriate for a desktop system. So we're not talking like, you know, a crazy 1,500-watt 12-inch subwoofer or something.
You still need to be within the realm that you can put it on your desk or under your desk or something like that. But obviously, the 2.1, if you get the 0.1, which is the subwoofer, you want good bass, a good fill bass.
Right.
And we noted that the Logitech 313 that we saw, we talked about in last episode, was lacking in, because all it had was just a 4-inch woofer. It wasn't really even a subwoofer. So you would get some bass notes, and that might fill in for the two small 2.5-inch mid-ranges that were in the satellites. But it's not going to give you any real fill bass.
And I think that's a key point, because when people think about subwoofers, there's two really almost competing trains of thought. And you see this mm-hmm. even in competition, right?
Right.
there's the quality of the bass, the fill, which is where the bass should complement the rest of the sound.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you shouldn't know that the bass is there.
And that's what most audiophiles are looking for, is the bass that fills in. So you've got essentially the entire listening range of music available for your ears, mm-hmm. whereas a tweeter can only go so low. And then the competitive side of it, the opposite side, and you and I have both been there also, mm-hmm. is the bass as a weapon, maybe?
The bass weapon. I think in the day we used to call them bass heads.
Bass heads. Yeah, so dB drag is the competition for that, right? Mm-hmm. How heavy can your bass hit? How loud can it go?
Yeah, and it was a real competition because bass waves are notoriously difficult to create. I mean, you can create bass waves, but to create amplified bass waves, you have to make a bunch of compromises. And some of those compromises are like, well, you need 6 batteries and 3 alternators to be able to run your 6,000 watt Series D into your 12/15.
And I think that's like a really key point, because this is one of the differentiators and one of the limitations in what we're trying to accomplish, is we aren't going to be trying to draw an insane amount of power, because it's not realistic for a desktop system.
Nope.
And we're not trying to, for lack of a better term, shake the pictures off the walls, right? So this is going with that first train of thought. Mm-hmm. We wanted good, clean bass fill that would complement desktop speakers.
Yep. And I added another requirement, in that it needed to be able to hit low.
Oh, okay.
Otherwise, why bother building a subwoofer enclosure unless you can get all of those frequencies?
Well, and this is what we identified as one of the problems with the Logitechs. Even the more expensive Logitechs, is they're not going to ship you with a big enough high performance system, because the power limitations, the size limitations,
and cost.
And of course, cost. With that in mind, I'm looking at, I think, a Frankenstein box here.
A Frankenstein. Well, it's not very pretty, if that's what you mean. So this was one of 3 enclosures that I talked about in that previous episode. And I'll link it down below in case you're new here and you haven't heard about this kind of stuff before.
So this box.
Yeah, it's a box.
Is a rough draft.
Yeah. So actually, all 3 of those designs that I've come up with are technically what I would call rough drafts. And my intention is that I will test each one of my designs. I'll refine them slightly. And then I'm going to do the show car appeal to the one that I like the most, and that will be what goes into my retro build.
So that's the pretty one.
Yeah.
So right away, I of course noticed that we've got a port. It looks like about a 2-inch port, maybe a little less.
Yeah, 2-inch ABS.
And we've got a speaker hanging out the front, or the back, or you know, depending on your orientation, the front.
We can see the magnet of this particular woofer, and this is the Tang Band 5 1/4-inch subwoofer. It's the same one we talked about in the previous episode. I got a sheet here. It's the, let's see, what is it? This is the W5-1138SMF.
Very memorable.
Super, super memorable.
I mean, SU series.
Yeah. Which, and it calls it a 5-inch paper subwoofer.
So one of the reasons that we chose this speaker originally was because we thought that we could make this work in the existing enclosure that came from our friends at Logitech.
And
it will.
On the paper, it should have fit just perfectly. But yeah, there's a lot of effort that needed to go to make it fit.
So instead, what we've decided to do, as you mentioned already, is manufacture a box. So I know you bought 2 speakers. Mm-hmm. I only see one. So I'm assuming that through some sort of audiophile magic, there's a second speaker inside here. So talk me through the build.
Okay. So right now, what we have is a 3/4 cubic foot enclosure built from 1/2-inch MDF particle board. Basically, this is what they build cabinets out of.
Yeah, very dense.
Very dense. Normally for subwoofer enclosures, like in a car, we would use 3/4-inch because that gives you better dampening, but this has relatively low power. It's a low size box that should be okay for dampening. We have our 5-inch subwoofer on the outside. Isobarically, which is where we have the 2 cones facing each other with a small airspace between them, there's another 5-inch inside the container. And those are wired in series because each one of these woofers is 4 ohm, and my plate amplifier is rated at 4 ohm, but there's no way to get 2 4-ohm speakers together to equal 4 ohms. It's just impossible.
Right.
So I increased the ohmage to 8, and actually, it worked out pretty well, because that way it could the plate amplifier was still within the range that these woofers would support in terms of power.
Okay, so I'm going to turn this thing around because I want to see this plate amplifier a little better.
Okay. And we talked about this in the last episode, but basically this is a LePI plate amplifier, and it has two channels inside it. So we have a stereo channel, which is 30 watts per channel, and then we have a mono, you know, where they bridge both of them together for 60 watts. And then that goes to my subwoofer, and we have a switch here where we can enable or disable the two amplifiers inside. Right now I have it just in the bass mode, which is, I think it's 0+1 or something like that.
Yeah, that's what it is.
And next to that is the power switch. We can turn it on and off. We have line in, line out, because this is an amplifier. We're going to take line level inputs. And we have the option to have speaker outs.
So this unit must have a built-in crossover then?
Mm-hmm. It does. It has this little dial here. It's the crossover, the bass crossover. I have it down quite a ways. And if we go and run our speakers off of this, what happens is that it splits the crossover. So the lower frequencies will go to the sub, the higher frequencies, wherever the crossover point is, will go to the other end of it.
So I know that you wanted to test these with that original setup, but you ended up going with different separate. So I want to mention that we've kind of upped our game a little bit with Creative Labs or Creative's GigaWorks T40s for the speakers to match it.
Yeah, we talked about that in the previous episode. And what I ended up doing was taking the line level output of this amplifier and then hooking the GigaWorks into that. Now, I could have used the Logitech ones and just used the speaker outs.
Right.
But in terms of power handling and efficiency, I can use the amplifier in the GigaWorks and control the treble and the bass independently of the subwoofer. So that way I can kind of tune it a little bit better. And I would think that the Creative Lab speakers would give me a better quality because it has three drivers in. We got two mid-range and one tweeter.
Yeah, and it's a much nicer speaker and, of course, a little more modern.
Mm-hmm.
I like the look of this on the back. It looks very professional to me. So I've seen the back, I've seen the front.
Mm-hmm.
I can't see inside.
So no.
We've got the two opposing speakers, but is this a single chamber inside?
Yes, it's a single chamber. And that 2-inch port is around 9 inches long.
Okay.
And in the WinISD modeling software, this should have a 3 dB peak at 35 hertz. Now, when I was testing this particular woofer, turns out that it was really peaking at plus 9 dB at 45 hertz. So the modeling and the way that it was measured, slightly different. And really, that tells me that I made the box too big, to be honest. But it sounds amazing.
Well, the disadvantage, I think, is based on the speaker size, right? Because bass is really dependent on the size of the speakers and how much they travel, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, it's the amount of air movement, because the bass
that makes sense.
The bass is generated by the movement of the cone, and if you have a much larger cone, then you'll be able to amplify those frequencies, and it will be able to move slower to the point where you'll be able to hit those lower notes. So we are limited by the 5-inch paper cone driver. And in an isobaric situation, you don't add amplification. Whereas if I had two speakers in the same box, just kind of pointing out, it should amplify it by about 15% or something like that. But by putting them isobarically together, what I'm getting is the ability to hit extremely low notes in a much smaller enclosure than what would be required if I only had one driver.
I think it's clear this is never going to replace the big monster subwoofers you have heard in some car stereos or if you've been to the club lately.
Yeah.
But it's not intended to.
No. Honestly, it's like with this particular amplifier, I could probably go with a single 6 or an 8-inch driver in the same size enclosure and have the same quality bass, almost a little bit better. But that kind of defeats the purpose of having something small.
Dennis, you mentioned that this is a little bit too big. And you found that through testing. So explain that to me.
Okay, so I hooked up a calibration microphone. And what I did was I sent in several pink noise and sine signals to the woofer and tried to map out where the different peaks were. Because ideally what I should see is a relatively flat bass curve. You know, there's going to be some humps back and forth. But if the box is designed correctly and sized for this particular woofer combination, it should go up slightly at like a, they call it a 12 dB octave curve, and then it should level out and pretty much be flat. Well, with this particular container, what I found was that I have my negative 3 dB at 33 to 35 hertz. That's where it was supposed to be. But then I saw a plus 6 to plus 9 at 40 hertz. So that means that it went up way too high. And when it does that, that means that there is too much volume in the container and the woofer is kind of going nuts. So I overtuned for that frequency. And then at that point, it comes down almost as sharply as it went up and kind of levels out where it's supposed to be. And then I found another peak at around 100 hertz, which also tells me that, well, the box can't contain the impedance change on the woofer. And by impedance change, that means that it's kind of making it more efficient. It's giving it a lot more amplification. And that's kind of that wave coming back through. And had the box been a lot smaller, it could contain that to the point where that curve will be flat.
So talk to me about the next steps. Are we going to try a new version of this box, or is it time to try version 2?
I am going to go for version 2. So I have, like I said, I have three boxes that I want to build. The first one is the isobaric, which is the one that you see here. And then the next one is just going to be basically a loudness box. It's going to be a fourth order. We got the two subwoofers in the same container, and that should raise the amplification something like 10 dB of over what we have here, and they'll be tuned around the same frequency. And at that point, if I measure that box and it turns out to be the same as this box, I'll know that the container's too big.
So if you want to see, or better even hear this, how would we get people to do that? Because it's not very podcast friendly.
It's not very podcast, that's for sure. And we were playing this before we were recording, and yeah, it definitely would not be able to be picked up. It can't even be picked up off of my phone. It's hitting too low. I'm doing a YouTube video on this, on the build process, how to put it together. There's some pictures on my Instagram and also on the Twitter, but there's going to be an entire series to these box building projects. And I'm going to get my calibration microphone. That's how I'm going to collect the sound samples. So you should be able to see and hear the bass frequencies in the YouTube video.
Very nice. Well, I look forward to seeing the next version of this, or maybe two versions by the next time we get together. Thanks, Dennis.
For more information on the topics discussed in this podcast, please consult our show notes on hardwareasylum.com. Stay up to date on the latest at Hardware Asylum by subscribing to our RSS and follow us on Twitter. This has been a Ninja Lane production, copyright 2022. Thanks for listening.